Blog Talk Radio.
What's happening, Blog Talk Radio? Today is Tuesday, March 10th, 2020. The call-in number is 347-857-3293. Special Super Tuesday analysis, special guest presentations, Ralph Showman, Taking Aim, Lisa Davis, Black is Back Coalition, Sharon Salam, Justice for the Wrongfully Incarcerated, Yejidai Orunmila, African People's Socialist Party, Nellie Bailey, Black Agenda Report.
Thank you for that, Victor. This is Ralph Pointer, what's happening? And you know what I believe, and I'm not going to read that because I've read it on every program. But I know that what we must do in terms of what I believe is to support and free all of our political prisoners. Now, the question on the minds of progressive people who work to influence the actions of American people is, what would American people do if they found out about the economics of American imperialism? The Vietnam War, the war in Vietnam, and issues surrounding the American government's promotion of the war made it clear to many that the American government lies to its people. What then are the results of this exposure? Well, our brother Tom Syracuse has given great detail in numbers of voters and non-voters. Joe Myers has given great social and psychological analysis of the American workers and their reasons for reacting the way that they do. I will continue with my last week's comment that Bloomberg has purchased almost as many Negroes as was bought and sold at the Louisiana auction of Angola that set records for the buying and selling of people of color known as slaves. And so I update my comments to last week, the endorsement of the gentleman of color in South Carolina who threw his vote and his support to Mr. Biden, not because of what Mr. Biden has done, because if he looked at what Mr. Biden had done, he might have taken lynching the other way and lynched Mr. Biden. And I remind people of Biden, Mr. Biden's votes regarding segregation and integration and racism. A Dixiecrat. I remind you of how he reacted as the so-called friend of Anita Hill and the so-called Democratic support of Anita Hill, including the Kennedys. They held back. They didn't tell half the truth of what was happening with Anita Hill while it was exposed many years later, not to help Anita Hill, but to help us understand where the Democratic Party is. And I say, if you know the truth, if the people know the truth, what will be their reaction? Well, they know the truth. And I will compliment followers of our misleadership class, as Glenn Ford so aptly calls them, the black misleadership class. The followers followed. They did what their leaders told them to do. And their leaders told them to stick their neck in the noose again for the Democratic Party. For the Democratic Party has done nothing but to support a few elite people of color, so-called elite. And they must laugh all of the way to the bank when they get the support of people of color who have no demands and no progress. Over the years, we talk about black exploitation. Today, we talk about reparations for slavery. We talk about reparations for the land grabs of the ex-slaves that happened after the Civil War. We talk about reparations for the housing debacle. We talk about 2008. We talk about reparations for what is happening today. Every time there is a problem of economics, we find we are wondering which is the greatest loss of economic value of a debacle. Was it 2008? Was it 2017? Was it 1867? Each one was detrimental to the people of color. And we talk about reparations, but we don't talk about stopping them from robbing from us today. And I say to you, the greatest robbery economically in the history of the relationship of people of color is in the education budget in the inner cities controlled by the Democratic Party. Look it up. We have these little things we call cell phones. There are facts. Go to the budgets. And of the Education Department. New York City, 21st largest budget in the whole world. What happened to that money? Our children end up in the prisons in all around New York. And the people, the racist people in all of the small communities in those prison towns benefit from the death and the destruction of our children's so-called education. And when they go to these prisons, the towns and the communities in which the prisons are held, and we're talking about census, the towns and the communities in which the prisons are held get federal finance based on their presence in the community, not the communities that they came from. Robbed one more time. I've been given the hook. I've been told that my time is up, and I hope I have expressed a few realities as to what's happening in America today. Next up, Sister Betty Davis.
Hello, everybody. Just want to let you know we've got a lot of special guests on this evening, so we're going to extend the time. After we have our poet, we always have liberation poetry because we honor Sister Lynn, who loved poetry. And then we've got a special guest from California, Brother Ralph Shellman. And we've got our usual, rounding up the usual suspects. We've got Tom, we've got Joe, and we've got a lot of people who just listen in. So we need you to hang in there. We're anticipating Sister Sharon. We hope she can call in as well. Take care. Here we go.
Don't miss it. And you can, these programs are archived, so you can dial them up sometime later. Professor Louie, your microphone is open. Educate us with poetry. Say it in a way that only the poets can say it.
You got it, Ralph. War is nasty, ugly and cold. It kills the body and rots the soul. For silver and gold, an old story is told. It's your life that's bought and sold. You thought a job in the army would teach you a skill, but the army's job is teach you to kill. You kill some guy you don't even know, a dude like you, a regular Joe with not too much dough, and he might kill you all the same. Lose your legs or lose your brain, and for a little more, that's hard to ignore. Check out the guys who fought the war. They had pride in our side. They fought with heart. Now they're out on your block with a shopping cart. They fought with what they thought was hope. Now they're down on the corner, strung out on dope. And does it matter to them when it's said and done if the war was lost or won? And do you really care, false or true, which oil company sells gas to you? And along with the pain and who's to blame, it's a sure enough shame. But war can drive a whole country insane. Wave the flag and believe in lies. Everybody gets crazy. It's no big surprise. We look around us and we could find the whole country could lose its mind and say we believe in a better world for every little bitty boy and girl, and say we believe in a cleaner earth, clean air and water. We know what it's worth. But when it comes to the world, if you really ask, war is the worst thing that can come to pass. It destroys everything in its path, burns through the earth like the grapes of wrath. And who gets to pay for all the waste, death and destruction all over the place? It's not too funny, it's low and crummy, but war is paid for with our money. Planes, bombs, guns, bullets too, army tanks, trucks, army socks and shoes, aircraft carriers on the ocean blue. The whole thing paid by you. Tons and tons of money all thrown away, gone from your check every payday. And who sold the bullets? Who sold the plane? They got a face and they got a name. Boeing, Halliburton and Lockheed, Bechtel, Grumman, IT&T, billion-dollar companies want billions more. Getting down to it, they don't mind war. Trillions of dollars up in smoke. Someone's making money while you go broke. March in everywhere, flags unfurled, so multinational companies can rule the world. And you kill somebody your same age, come home and they pay the minimum wage. No matter the war is won or lost, who who made the profit, who paid the cost. No matter the war is lost or won, the flag don't wave for everyone. It waves for a new corporate foreign factory. It waves for your brother in the cemetery. And you kill somebody you never met to try and get something you will never get. And we might not want feelings or even dealings with people who kill. It's awful and ill, but say what you will. Being a killer is a bitter pill. There's a ragged, broke veteran all out on the street, shoes all torn up. You can see his feet. He fought the war, but the war wasn't kind. He's out of the war and out of his mind. So I don't want to listen when the trumpets blow. I don't believe what I hear on the radio. I listen for the voice of those who are gone. I listen for the voice of the baby and mom. And if you care about your family and your home, if you care about the children, not even grown, if you want your money to stay and not ever roam, if you want to buy your kid an ice cream cone, if you want a little help with your student loan, if you want to lift everyone to a higher zone, if you check out the facts with a fine-tooth comb, if murder is murder, even with a drone, if you can hear the dead and the dying moan, then it's true from here to eternity, from the clear blue sky to the deep blue sea. Killing other people will not make them free, and war is not the best thing for you and me, because war is nasty, ugly and cold. It kills the body and rots the soul. For silver and gold, an old story is told. It's our lives that are bought and sold.
Thank you, my brother, Professor Louis. And remember, this program is archived, and I promise you, and our technician sitting beside me, Ernesto Stewart, said he's putting that to music and rhythm. And he made that promise. You and I will hold him to that. You got to hear this over and over again. And I say, have you learned anything from that poetry? As Lynn Stewart would say over and over again, the poets could say it as no one else can say it to make you understand. Thank you, Professor Louis. Once more time. Next up, from the West Coast, that we all on the East Coast know, taking aim, Ralph Shulman, Maya Shone. We have a little bit of what they've been doing. Ralph, your microphone is open.
How have you been, Ralph? Good talking to you.
Hanging
Hi,
in there. Look. Hi, Maya. Looking in, we're looking so forward to hearing your voice on this Blog Talk Radio, so much talked about on WBAI. Give us some more information.
Ralph, we didn't get a chance to speak last week in the homage to Lynn. So we wanted to go back and continue in that vein, particularly about how Lynn was freed, the compassionate release effort, because that really shows the totality and the depth of what we can do when we band together and organize. As everyone knows, it was in 2002 that Lynn was first targeted by then President George Bush and Attorney General John Ashcroft for providing a vigorous defense of her client, the blind Egyptian cleric, Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, which he was doing with former Attorney General Ramsey Clark. And after his conviction and when he was sent to jail, she and Ramsey Clark continued in their defense of the blind Sheikh. But by 2002, after the events of 9/11, Ashcroft and Bush started to persecute and decided to prosecute Lynn. And for over 13 years, there was a tremendous struggle, a long time struggle of a woman who had devoted over 30 years to defending the voiceless. And the whole entire legal community knew that. There was just one reason for this. In 2003, and that was through the institution of our beloved Lynn, it was meant to intimidate the entire legal community so that few would dare to defend political clients. And as Dick Gregory said, these are the people whom the state demonizes. And he did this so that no one would provide a vigorous defense. And above all, Lynn...
We're losing you. We're losing you.
One of the oppressed. You're losing us? Can you hear?
I can hear you now.
Hello?
Continue. I can hear you. Please continue.
So the part of the prosecution and persecution of Lynn was meant to narrow the meaning of the First Amendment right of free speech. People don't think about that when they think about Lynn's case, because one of the things it was to do was to prevent Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman from speaking out and prevent the advocate for him from speaking out. So it was not just an attack of defense, it was an attack on the free speech rights of each and every one of us. So Lynn, in effect, was an ominous threat to the freedom, rights, and dignity of all Americans. And as Dick Gregory, who provided a vigorous defense of Lynn, in fact, from the Martin Luther King, the day of his, from April 4th, 2013, Greg went on a fast. He refused all solid food, and he maintained that until Lynn was freed and was able to get the medical treatment that you and the rest of her family so lovingly attended to. And the support of you and Betty throughout were absolutely crucial. So I would like to say now that throughout those years, what was remarkable about the people of New York and also nationally and then internationally was how people rallied. The courtroom was always full. There were always demonstrations. When it came time for the sentencing, Judge Codal, he was inundated with huge loose leaves of letters from lawyers, from prosecutors, from federal officials, from former clients, defendants. I mean, so much. I mean, it was never would he have ever seen so much support. It was such that despite what the federal government was asking in terms of a sentence, Judge Codal gave her what he considered the minimum. And again, that was not sufficient for the federal government prosecutors who appealed and the right-wing judges. And at the time, Ralph and I, and particularly Ralph, did an analysis of who the judges were on the Court of Appeals. They slammed Lynn and provided her with a 10-year sentence, which since Lynn had cancer and had fortunately, at that time, was in remission, it was going to be a death sentence at her age. And consequently, when she was placed in Carswell, instead of in a facility that would be closer for you and the family to visit, such as Danbury, her cancer flared up again. And she also needed other surgery, and they took 18 months. I mean, they were out to kill her one way or another. And that is why the family and Ralph and I and others, we launched. Yes, Ralph?
Go ahead, Maya.
We found a section of the federal law that allows for compassionate release. And this is a section that exists in the law, but as the Inspector General of the Justice Department and as the human rights organizations have noted, it is hardly ever used, hardly ever used. So we knew this was going to be an uphill battle. And the petition started, and within a few months, this is what happened. Ralph, it is totally amazing that because of Lynn, as you know, The prison warden had to hire extra people to deal with all the letters that were coming in for Lynn Stewart. Letters daily from people, so much mail that he had to hire somebody specifically to look at her mail. And what we did is not only just mail, we went and used, it was the first time for us to ever use the internet and use a digital appeal. And we gathered remarkably by people extending the appeal from place to place, over 40,000 people. Now that means that the Bureau of Prisons, the prison warden, they were inundated. They were so inundated that the Bureau of Prisons server went down. And then we had people making telephone calls, and they couldn't, they had to stop answering their phones. And on top of that, Ramsey Clark was basically living on their doorstep. And you and Betty were essentially took up residency in front of the White House. And we got people like Dick Gregory and Lou Wolf of Covert Action and people marching in front of the Bureau of Prisons such that the staff couldn't go in the front door. They had to go in the back door in order to get to work. And as I think you told us, they were waving from the windows in support of Lynn. So this is to show, to rally everybody, to the fact that we can actually do this when we band together and we join and we spread out and we contact other people. And in our own defense, we can do this. And what Lynn always made clear, that her freedom is a step towards the freedom of other political prisoners. And we have to never, never forget that this is what we have to do until each and every one of the political prisoners is freed. Ralph?
Well, I want to say a few words, Ralph, about the advocacy of Lynn, because she represented the defenseless. She represented those who were charged by the state with crimes which they had not committed but were essentially political charges. And a rather dramatic example, which Maya was alluding to, was the case of Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, who was an Egyptian cleric who happens to be blind with advanced diabetes such that he had no longer sensation in his fingers so that he could even read Braille. But nonetheless, he was a very active figure with two mosques in Brooklyn that serviced the poor emigres from Egypt and other countries who were taxi cab drivers and subject to persecution themselves. And in the mosque where Sheikh Omar Rahman held forth, these youngsters came and were assisted by him, and the FBI penetrated the walk-up mosque and would approach these youngsters and invite them to meetings where these FBI undercover agents would make wild propositions to these kids, such as blowing up the Brooklyn Bridge and the George Washington Bridge and the Lincoln Tunnel and the Holland Tunnel, absurd things for youngsters with no possibility of even considering such actions. And then on the basis of these planted propositions, they would make accusations of acquiescence and ascribe them to the blind sheikh himself, who was completely unaware of it. These are the circumstances, just the little beginning of what they were up to, which Lynn was confronting in defending the blind sheikh. And what the regime did was to ascribe to her lawyer responsibility for the putative acts of her client, of which she was innocent. Just the lawyer, by virtue of merely defending the sheikh, is culpable for the crimes that were ascribed to him, which makes it impossible to have a defense for anybody in the legal system in the United States. It's an assault on the basic right to a defense, because if a lawyer is responsible for the crimes of the client, opposed to the advocacy of his rights, no lawyer can afford to defend anybody in the U.S. An assault on the basic right to legal defense in the society at large. This is what colored our mobilization in defense of Lynn and what she represented. It involved, as Maya said, defense in every country, 40,000 signatories of the prominent. And meanwhile, while the campaign was ongoing, Lynn was railroaded into prison with advanced cancer. Years of the mobilization that produced her release. It's a complex and long story to detail it all.
Anyway, we wanted to join with all the others last week who we heard, but somehow the phone connection didn't work, to honor Lynn and to really honor the work of everyone who mobilized. I mean, it was so incredible that the We Will Not Be Silent women went to Carswell at one point, and on the road to the federal prison, there they were with their signs, you know, just as they were outside the federal court or outside of MCC. But they trekked all the way to Texas, and it was a real testament to the depth and the breadth of all the people who mobilized to free Lynn. But most of all, the efforts of you and Betty, who consistently, daily, from morning, 24 hours a day, breathed and lent the inspiration for this effort.
Well, thank you so much for that, Maya, because I'm sitting here, and I'm not supposed to cry on this program, but I'm remembering when a nation was terrorized with the thought of being a terrorist. Those strong voices of liberty, you reminded me weekly at Taking Aim. You spoke on these issues, the courage that you gave to all of us. This is what is needed today, and this is what we are trying to do, to continue that struggle, dare to struggle, dare to win, dare to tell the truth, speak truth to unjust governments in the face of terror from the government. Thank you, Maya and Ralph, once again for bringing us back to those days of those who showed courage and who won the race, who ran the race and won. Thank you so much. At Maya and Ralph Shulman Taking Aim. See you again soon.
Bye-bye.
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 Next up, Sharon Salam. Your microphone is open. Sharon Salam, your microphone is open. Okay, next. Lisa Davis, your microphone is open. Ann Lamb, your microphone is open.
Well, thank you, Ralph. Always an honor to be on this show with you and Sister Betty and your family there. That was beautiful. That was beautiful to listen to and very important because, you know, it shows, like you say, when we fight, we can win. You know, dare to struggle, dare to win. So I have a few things to say tonight. First of all is that the Saturday event that was coming up for Del Africa has been postponed. So I can't say any more than that at the moment, but it's been postponed and we'll plan to reschedule. I just want to let people know that. But you can go to onamove.com, that's onamove.com, and you can certainly give some donations for recently released MOVE members, which are most of them now. There are no more MOVE 9 people in prison. They did lose 2 people over the years inside, which, as you know, from, you know, talking about Lynn and FMC Carswell, you know, they call that the Federal Medical Center. I call it the Federal Murder Center, you know. When Marilyn Buck was there, who also ended up dying of cancer very shortly after her release, and she had some kind of problem with the leg and was wearing a brace, the COs would deliberately stick their feet out to trip her so she would fall on the floor. So, you know, we know what kind of medical care people don't get in these places. It's awful. They'll deliberately delay everything in the hope that people will die because that's what they want, and we know that. So in addition to donating some money to recently released MOVE members and other recently released political prisoners, if you go to JerichoNY.org, we have a little thing down on the left side, and that lists everybody, you know, individual fundraisers for various people who have recently been released. So people can do it that way, too. Or you can go down to MOVE.com, make a donation to the MOVE organization. You know, they now have a whole bunch of people home, which is great. But, you know, that also requires, you know, finances and resources. And then we have, of course, the case of our dear friend, Dr. Mitulu Shakur, who is also trying for compassionate release at this time, second round, right? And they are also looking for not only donations, which are always useful for the legal effort, because now he's done round one. That was denied. Now he's in round two. It actually goes back to the original. It's amazing. It goes back to the original trial judge, whose name is Judge Haight. He's still sitting on the bench in the Southern District of New York. So this is very interesting. So the lawyers are looking for, you know, some money for legal funds. And also there's an online petition that people can sign in support of compassionate release for Mitulu, just like we did for Lynn, you know. So people should definitely go to MituluShakur.com and follow instructions. And you can also, if you don't know much about Mitulu, you can certainly inform yourself as to who Dr. Mitulu Shakur is and his years and years of dedication. If you don't know about, you know, the Lincoln Detox Center back in the day, you can certainly learn. And that would be a good thing. So people, you know, we need to step up to the plate. Like we said, we did it for Lynn. We proved it's possible. The MOVE organization has certainly proved it's possible to pull your people out of there as long as it might take, more than 40 years. Okay, so that's a long, long, dedicated struggle. Mitulu has been in prison for 34-plus years for really, you know, he was totally framed up on RICO. He himself says that he was convicted based upon his fingerprints on a public flyer that he was handing out to people. So there you go, you know. And they would love to use the word terrorist against all of our freedom fighters, and we know that. And we should not be afraid of that because that's the word that gets thrown around. And, you know, we should be proud. I'm very proud to say some of my friends are called terrorists by this government. It doesn't bother me in the least. This government is, you know, as we know, the number one terrorist on the planet. I don't want to be too long because I know you have a lot of people waiting to speak, but I would encourage everybody, you know, go to onamove.com. It doesn't have to be a lot of money. If you can donate, you know, just a couple of bucks, donate a couple of bucks. You know, like we say, no donation is too small, and of course, no donation is too large. And the same thing, MitulushaCore.com, very important right now. He has stage 3 bone marrow cancer. He's been in excruciating pain for more than a year. Once again, typically being the Bureau of Prisons, he did not receive medical care in a timely fashion. He did not get the test done in a timely fashion because, as we know, these are death camps, and this government is bound and determined that all of our political prisoners should die in prison. And we have made it clear that we are not putting up with that. We are not accepting that. And you, Ralph, were the biggest inspiration to many people when you said, no, I do not accept that. My wife is not going to die in prison. And she didn't. And that was partially due to, you know, Daniel McGowan called me when she first got out and before she even came back to the city. And he was like, that's amazing. And I said, no, Daniel, that is the power of love. And as Fred Hampton said, we don't fight fire with fire. We fight fire with water. We're not going to fight hate with hate. We're going to fight hate with love, which is one of the reasons that he was killed as well, for being an inspirational person who was inspiring many young people. So, you know, the struggle continues, and I am inspired by all of our people who have gone to the ancestors, in addition to our people who are still alive, and we are going to do it because we have said we're going to do it. What's the call? Freedom all. All power to the people.
Thank you so much for that, Ann Lamb. And I'm sitting here, and I say, I don't want to cry on the program, but I'm listening to the voices of strength. when state terror frightens a nation. And, along with the Shonwins, was very instrumental in that period, and I'm sure will be instrumental in the period going forward, because state terror is getting worse. Next up, Yejide Owerenmila, African People's Socialist Party, your microphone is open.
Uh-huh. Thank you so much, Betty and Ralph, for having me on tonight. Appreciate it. As always, I'm just enjoying everybody speak before me. I'm on tonight to make sure that your listeners know about an upcoming event that we're having. I belong to the African People's Socialist Party, but as a department of the party, I lead the African National Women's Organization. And this year we're celebrating our fifth year of existence, and it's been a really growing 5 years. And so this convention, which we dubbed the Black Women's Convention Sisters United for the Revolution, will be happening in Philadelphia on March 28th and 29th at Imhotep Institute Charter High School in Philadelphia. So we're going to have, the basis for us organizing is led by the African internationalism, which is a theory of that was created by our chairman, Omalia Shatella. And the work that we do to raise up the political consciousness of Black women, poor and working class African women in our communities by taking on things that would keep us away from the revolution. So there's a lot of there's a lot of issues that are in our community that people don't see on the surface that really deeply impact African women. One of them is one of the initiatives that we have been organizing on since 2016 around the state-sponsored kidnapping of African children and how African children are disproportionately represented in the foster care system. And we also are working to establish a dual and contending power institution that can contend with the foster care system, where African people and our community come to the aid of African women and African children who are being impacted or might be targeted by the system. We also have a campaign that works around mass incarceration, political prisoners, African women who are in prison. And so this convention is going to speak to all of that, and out of it, we are establishing resolutions. We have some really important people on our program. We do have Janine and Janet Africa, who, as you well know, are recently released political prisoners with the MOVE organization. And we also have, healthcare services, and we also have people who are talking about state-sponsored kidnapping. But more than just being a talk fest, we are about organizing. And we don't subscribe to, this is Women's History Month, and we do it in this month because we do our conventions every year in this month as a sort of protest, but also raising up the whole question of, African women and our role in history, not just as people who were a part of liberation struggles, but as African women who are, and for the African women, the millions of African women who continue to be abused by this system, exploited by this system, for whom a revolution has to be made in order to free us all of our people. Because as long as we continue to maintain the capitalist system, the parasitic capitalist system, then our people, African women, everybody who is on the planet is going to suffer and continues to suffer. So we are celebrating, all these little victories that are really important, because that really shows, that trains us to be revolutionaries. But if we don't destroy the system that's creating these instances where we are continuously being oppressed, we're going to always deal with this over and over and over again. So African internationalism helps us see, as African women, our responsibility as more than half of the African nation. Like, African women make up a majority of the community of in the African nation, that our responsibility to ourselves, our responsibility to the future of our people, our responsibility for humanity is to be a part of organization, organize around destroying parasitic capitalism, organizing to stop the special oppression that African women face in our communities, and being a part of revolutionary trajectory of winning freedom and destroying parasitic capitalism so that we can have, you know, a world free from exploitation and oppression. And so without the, we don't want to follow the same pitfalls that other movements have made, thinking that after a revolutionary overthrow that there is going to be a process whereby women can be put into this, you know, into a process of the new society. We're starting right now. We're saying we're arming African women. We're training African women. We are coming into this process where we are looking at theory. We're looking at practice. And this convention is all about really arming our people, arming people who are in solidarity with us to how they can really be in solidarity with African women, and really helping everyone understand, like, what are the issues that deeply impact us and how we have to, and what new strategies that we have to do to overturn them. Because as long as we are, you know, much of what we've been doing has been, you know, stuff that we've learned from 50 years ago, and we have to now employ, like, different and new strategies for winning, but also to include the struggles of Black women as a, you know, and to the regular struggles of the overarching struggles of African people to be free. Because if we are tied up in these, in these issues, then we're not going to see the bigger picture. So this convention is, you know, for us is groundbreaking. We just had a, we have a, our sister organization, our organization in South Africa just had their founding conference in Soweto, and they have established their executive committee. So we are an international organization. We have comrades in Cameroon. We have comrades throughout the United States, and we have comrades in England and the Caribbean. So we are about building the international network of African women who are fighting for the revolution, and we have to do that on all fronts. And so we're really looking forward to this convention. And also Sister Betty has agreed to be at the convention and talk on one of our panels, and I'm really excited about that. And she has to get all the information, which she will get. But I just really, you know, think that the time is now. And, you know, with everything that's happening in the world, like, you know, nobody but us can bring us forward. So I just wanted to make sure that you all knew that, but also your listeners knew that as well. Uhuru.
Well, thank you for that, Yajide Oromila. And I say to everyone else, we have lost some of our inspirational women, Marilyn Buck, Lynn Stewart, so many beyond our ability to give you the names tonight. You must see and hear this young woman speak and act. You will hear more about it on our program going forward. Thank you so much, Yajide.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to try and see if we can get Sister Sharon one more time, see if she's still on. And if not, we're going to go straight to Sister Lisa and Brother Tom. Hang in there, please.
Sharon, your mic is open.
Yes, how are you?
We're here. We're waiting for your words of wisdom. Tell us what's going on, Sharon Salam.
Well, we're trying to push forward in terms of justice for those people who've been wrongfully incarcerated over at Justice for the Wrongfully Incarcerated. We are trying to even the field so that they have a better opportunity to live their lives successfully. We've got bills up in Albany that we're trying to push forward on behalf of those people, and we're asking people to call in on the bills. And we also have a walk to Albany that we are planning to do. We're going to be leaving out of here on May 19th, and we're going to be arriving in Albany on, we're leaving out of here on May 10th, which is Mother's Day. And we're leaving from Harlem right here on 110th and Lenox Avenue at Central Park, and we're going to be walking to Albany. It's going to take us until May 19th to get there. We're going to be stopping along the way, educating people about what's happening in the prison industrial complex, particularly among those people who've been wrongfully and adjudicated through the court. This bill is about them. It's about leveling the field so that they can get proper compensation for the time that they have spent in prison. And also, they can get services for that time as well. The number of this bill in the Senate, in New York State Senate, is A3978A. And the number in the bill is both in the Senate and in the Assembly. It's being being headed and spearheaded by in the Senate. It's by Brian Benjamin, and in the Assembly, it's by Efron Jeffries, right out here in Queens, and Benjamin is right here in Harlem. We need the support of the community to help make these bills a reality, to make it for all those years. We have people coming out of jail who spent 30 years, 25 years, 10 years, 3 months. Just recently, a young fellow came out of jail after spending 3 months for a crime he didn't commit. He never had a trial. But they held him in jail for 3 years, and most of you probably are familiar with that case. That was a young man in relation to the backpack. He was on his way to school with his backpack. The police accused him of stealing their backpack and put him in jail. 3 years he lingered there, not one trial. Finally, they decided to drop the charges. The young boy, he comes out from the jail, and within a short span of time committed suicide because of all the awful things that had happened to him while he was incarcerated. We have to stop this. People have to be held accountable for the wrong they do. And this bill, a leg up for those people who need our help and our respect after going through all these processes. Now, this particular bill, it is one that is called Wrongful Conviction Recovery Act. And it's geared to assisting those people who've been adjudicated through the courts. That means that after they were convicted and spent time in jail, a court came back and said, oh, you have the wrong people. We still need to start looking toward accountability for those people who have done these deeds to these men, women, and children who are being imprisoned. It's very sad when you look at this. Years ago, we had a large population of men who were going to prisons. That was the overwhelming population. Then they started taking the women, the mothers, and placing them in prison. And now they're taking our children and placing them in prison. We have to really start speaking out about the injustice that's happening in our communities. There are times when people commit crimes, and those people should pay. There are times when people have not committed crimes and they are paying also. Because when you have the wrong person in jail for a crime they did not commit, that frees up the person who committed the crime to go out and commit other crimes. It's really something. It's really something. And it's a stain on our society that these types of things are happening and happening so freely in our communities. And
well, thank you.
We have to stand tall.
Well, thank you so much for that, Sister Salam. But we have to. We are involved in a many-pronged offense, but we have to remind ourselves that demands for justice, for our participation in the electoral system, must be made and kept. We cannot continue talking about this. It's time for demands, and if it's too late for demands, it's too late for our vote. So let's put the votes and the demands together. Thank you for that so much. And we're extending the program has been extended, and we have next up Lisa Davis. 1405. Lisa, your mic is open.
Hello there, Ralph Poynter. How are you doing?
Well, we're waiting for the words of wisdom from Lisa Davis in New Jersey. Talk to us, Lisa.
The word, I will gladly talk with you. First of all, let me just say this because I did not get the chance to call in last week. I mean, I wasn't able to get on, but I just have to open up with just showing my love and my salute to our wonderful comrade, Lynn Stewart. And when people transition on, I don't speak of them in past tense because their lives and what they did are still with us. And I just want to say, I mean, I found her to be such a wonderful, wonderful person, and I just loved working with her. I'm a member of the Black is Back Coalition, and she was a strong friend of the Black is Back Coalition, a strong ally. But I just want to say that she literally fought right up until her last day in this form of existence, on this side of existence, because we had a program. In fact, a program scheduled with Sharon Salam and Yusef Salam, and it was on the central, well, they are the Exonerated Five now, but then they were still referred to as the Central Park Five. We were showing the Burns documentary about them, and we were going to have a panel afterwards, and Lynn Stewart was a part of that panel. And when I had approached her about participating, because one of the lawyers at the school, one of the young lawyers who was studying law, really wanted Lynn to be on that panel, and she asked me if I could get her. And so when I called her, she without hesitation said yes. And of course, I did not know what was going to happen, but I'm just so moved by her wonderful spirit that right up until the very last minute, she was ready and prepared. And, of course, we know she was not able to attend, but her spirit was to attend. So I think that's just tremendous. And I found out after the program was over that she had made her transition that night. But she was scheduled to participate in that program in Newark, New Jersey.
Well, thank you for that. So what projects are you involved in at this moment?
I am the chair of the healthcare working group of the Black is Back Coalition, and you can just imagine that with what is currently going on with this quote-unquote coronavirus pandemic, and the pandemic is nothing to take lightly, so I don't mean to make light of that, but the fact that we have it here and how it is being somewhat politicized, I think, you know, there are a lot of important issues that we need to deal with pertaining to this. And one of the things that I am certainly learning is that the CDC and the World Health Organization really are not preparing us, at least not our communities, for how we should really deal with this. I'm extremely disappointed by the information that they put out. And we just continue to hear, okay, wash your hands, don't touch anybody, don't touch your face, continuously, as they basically prime us to accept that there's nothing we can do unless they come up with some kind of vaccine. And I think that's just reprehensible. I think that's irresponsible of them. They are supposed to be the Center for Disease Control in the World Health Organization, and yet they say nothing about building up your immune system. They don't talk anything at all about the natural things that we can at least do to build up our immune systems and to give us some kind of protection or some kind of way to combat the threat of this disease or the infection if we should encounter it. So I think a lot needs to be said about that. I think our communities have got to come together. I am working with people in Newark to have an in-person forum or community meeting about how we can be there for each other beyond what the CDC is saying, because they're not going to help us. They never help us with anything. But we have within our ability the ability to help ourselves. We have resources within our community, and we need to let our neighbors know. We need to let each other know that, hey, you can call on me if you need this, or I have this kind of skill, but how can we to help each other through these kind of perilous times? And it should be a system of planning even beyond a pandemic, but certainly we have to have a preparedness that we are ready for our, within our community. And I also want to say that we need to also include in that preparedness a plan for two very vulnerable populations, and that are that is people who are homeless or who are living on the street and people who are incarcerated. You know, what is to be done to make sure that they are properly serviced, that they are cared for with nurture. It's very important to approach people with nurture, not with isolation, although I do understand that there might be times that people may have to be quarantined or however that goes, but the heart with which we approach that will be everything. And I'm really concerned with people who are incarcerated and people who are living on the street. I mean, how will they be treated? And I know how they get treated. You know, I see how they get treated almost every day when I come into New York. Now add the burden of a pandemic to that, a burden of a pandemic in which we are told that we shouldn't really be touching people. Add that to what they already go through. You know, so I'm really concerned about that.
Well, thank you so much for that, Lisa Davis. And I will rephrase what you say, our own abilities of constant preparedness. I will short-term that whole expression to political power. We must develop political power that defends us. And we must say defends us at home, on the street, or in prison, in incarceration, in the death camps. But we must remember New Orleans. What happened when the waters came? Our people died. We are not prepared. Lisa Davis is one of the people who constantly talks about us being prepared for whatever happens in the future. And there's only one way. We must have political power, and political power is gained through understanding and togetherness. Not this just, we must all be together nonsense. I'm talking about correct political thinking and togetherness. And you've heard some of that this evening, and we're going to continue doing this throughout the week. Next up is our analyst, Tom Syracuse. Tom, your mic is open. Joe, hang in there. We'll be ready for you. Gwen, we know the usual suspects. Be ready. Tom, your mic is open.
Thank you very much, everyone. I'd like to talk about how the Democratic Party blames the Greens and others for their losing elections. The Daily Beast is well-named. It's a wolf in sheep's clothing, posing as a progressive outlet and repeating the propaganda that the Democratic Party has put out against the Green Party, such as, the Green Party is responsible for Al Gore and Hillary Clinton losing the election to Bush number two, and then to Trump. The Democratic Party claims that if the Green Party had not run its presidential candidate in swing states, most Greens would have voted for the Democratic candidate. This is called the spoiler argument. Even Al Gore refused to claim this. I have been very active in the Green Party for many years, and I know of no Green who voted for the Democratic candidate if the Green Party does not run its own candidate. There is no evidence or polls taken that the Greens would vote Democrat. Likewise, did the Conservative Libertarian Party take votes away from the Republican Party? This widely held, quote, spoiler belief, in effect, is saying that since recent presidential elections are closely contested between the two major parties, there is no room third parties in our political system. This is a totally undemocratic idea that prevents those who are turned off by both parties and from even considering an alternative party. No wonder that more than 50% of those eligible to vote do not consider voting for an independent anti-corporate party like the Green Party. But why are recent presidential elections so close in the first place? The Green Party says it is because there are no significant differences between the two corporate parties. And that is why we call those two parties, quote, the Republicrat duopoly. And that is the real reason that the Democratic leadership lost and might lose this next election. The electorate is fed up with establishment candidates like Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden. Trump, however, was able to portray himself as an anti-establishment figure and appealed to the white working class that had been abandoned by the Democratic Party when Bill Clinton became president. After 4 years of Trump's deception, who knows what will happen in November as the economy is failing and the stock market is having unprecedented swings up and down, especially with the coronavirus spreading throughout the world. Not only is the Green Party blamed for the Democrats losing the elections in 1998 and 2012, but the Green Party is accused of unwittingly or willingly cooperating with Putin's alleged interference with the presidential elections. The so-called proof is that both Jill Stein and Howie Hawkins appeared on Russian TV, RT, and that Stein even attended a banquet for RT in Moscow. And I notice that my cable company, Spectrum, no longer carries RT. Does the Daily Beast point out that Green candidates are blocked from the corporate national TV stations in this country? In 1988, the two major parties took over the organizing and broadcasting of the presidential debates, which had been under the auspices of the League of Women Voters. Well, that ended any debates that included third-party candidates. However, in 1992, the multimillionaire Ross Perot bought time on national TV, and he received 19% of the vote for president, even without the chance to debate the two major party candidates. The polls indicated that Perot did take many votes away from Bush number one. But at least the Republicans did not blame Perot for their losing the election, while the Democratic Party tries to convince rank-and-file Democrats that they win the elections fairly, although they have engaged in fraudulent practices in the past. If the Democrats lose, it is because, they say, of Republican fraudulent tactics or Russian interference, or they blame the Green Party. A good example of the Democratic fraudulent practices was the role of Chicago's Mayor Daley in the election of JFK. Bernie Sanders, the self-proclaimed socialist, said in 2016, and now again in 2020, that he will support whomever the Democratic Convention nominates, even though the Democratic Convention engages in all sorts of undemocratic tactics in blocking his nomination. But the Daily Beast claims that the Green Party has divided the left by insisting on running its own candidate, and that even the iconic leftist Noam Chomsky, has asked the Green Party not to run in so-called swing states. I hope the left will not fall for the notion that to vote for anyone the corporate Democratic Party nominates, that's often called voting for the lesser of two evils, is better than whom the Democrats call the greater evil, Trump. Howie Hawkins, the leading Green Party candidate, answers all these arguments that the Daily Beast presents. I refuse to vote for an evil, even the so-called lesser evil. And I support Howie Hawkins or whoever the Green Party convention nominates. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Tom. As I tell people, listen in. When you hear Tom Syracuse, you hear about information, information, information in great detail and facts. And as we say that Howie Hawkins, we support Howie Hawkins, and I said to Howie Hawkins many times, be the head candidate for the Green Party because you understand and are the voice of the working man and women. And I say for the people in the Democratic Party, they were denied their own vote when they voted for Bernie Sanders against Hillary Clinton, and their vote was stolen, and they are silent. And so that was what I talk about. I speak of the mindset of people, so-called liberals, who allow their vote to be stolen, and I say they certainly are not going to protect my vote. And so Sister Betty wants to say a few words.
We just want to make it clear that we don't fall for the two-party mythology system. And we're also very disappointed that the blackness leadership class, it's one thing if they want to go into slavery, but they're counting on the loyalty of the black community to always support the black candidates and the black leaders, political leaders. And I think it's time we stop following the blackness leadership class and started destroying the Electoral College and started destroying the two-party system. I also want to make a special announcement. Again, we've extended the time. WBAI Fight Back is having a meeting on Thursday, the 12th, at 6:30, and it will be held at 6:30 at the Van Arsdale School for Labor Studies. That's at 325 Hudson Street, downtown Manhattan, on the 6th floor. It's on the corner of Van Dam Street, and the building's entrance is actually on Van Dam Street. Once again, you must come to the aid of your public radio station. If we do not fight, then who? March 12th, 6:30, the Van Arsdale School for Labor Studies, 325 Hudson Street. The struggle continues to save Pacifica, to save WBAI, and you have to step up to the plate. I want to emphasize again, this blog is for whoever's gonna take it down. We support anyone who's opposed to capitalism, who's opposed to fascism, who's opposed to racism. And anyone is our enemy that would sell us back into slavery. And it is despicable the way someone can, South Carolina can come up for Biden and not even make demands. There was a time in the civil rights movement, and I'd separate that from the human rights movement, when we would at least demand jobs. We would at least demand public, accountable, community control of education. That fool didn't even make demands. He just said he knew his heart. Well, we know his heart. We know the heart of Bloomberg. We know the heart of the Rockefellers. We know the heart of the Nazis. And the heart of all of these people is opposed to the working class. And that is why we stand opposed to them. The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Thank you so much for that angry response, but just an honest response, Sister Betty. Next up is Joel Myers, who always has a great intellectual understanding of what we are about. Joel Myers, your mic is open.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
hello?
I hear you. Yes,
okay.
I hear you, Joel.
I want to address two of these problems here. One is the duopolistic election scenario where we're forced to it's like somebody is in a fight, and they say, now, which do you prefer? Do you prefer a straight right or a left hook? Either one will knock you out, but this is the choice that you're being given. They call it a choice. Well, that is, and then they, supposedly we have some kind of a democratic republic, but in fact we have a total monopolization by what amounts to one party, a corporate party, Democrats and the Republicans, which may differ or may agree to disagree on certain things in order to keep people divided. They agree on 99% of how the country is to be run and how to protect the top elite from the interests of the people whose money has been stolen to make them the top elite. They say you have to support this system in general that robs everybody and will give you a straight right or a left hook for your efforts. That's if you win. Otherwise, you'll get the opposite punch in the face or in the chest, whichever one. And again and again and again. And another analogy is that we have we're in a wrestling match with a tag team, that is the Republicans and the Democrats. And whenever one of them may stumble or something, the other one gets tagged and comes into the ring and takes over for however many years, at the presidential level, at the congressional level, at the city council level, at the state legislature level. It's all the same thing. It's passing the power back and forth. Yes, there may be some differences, and people may feel that they have a stake in those. However, they're presented with the structure that only those who have the support of the major parties can realistically fill the political seats which transmit the policies of those who are higher up, those who have the billions, those who run the think tanks, who basically tell the president what to do, the so-called advisors. You know, like when they assassinated this Iranian leader, Soleimani. This was a political assassination. But do you think that somebody like Trump or somebody like Pompeo ever heard of Soleimani? They were advised, they were told what to do, whom to do it to, and a lot of this is an international situation of the top elite. It's not even necessarily Americans. It's an international ruling class, and for example, the Soleimani assassination looks like it was mainly focused on the interests of the Israeli state, with the United States as its protector, enforcer, and enabler. So this is the situation that we're confronted with. So the idea is what can we propose to get around this? And I think that people have been pushing to some degree for an electoral reform so that instead of just voting for one candidate, you can vote for a list of candidates. This was being done for a while with WBAI in terms of electing station boards and so on, where you vote. So, for example, let's say you're in the 1988 election. You don't want Bush to get in. You don't like Al Gore very much, but you think that he won't, that we'll have more time to live under him, and maybe 4 years from then we could change things for the better or whatever. But you see the Green Party, say, and they're running a positive campaign with a positive outlook. Now, if you could vote for a list of preferences, you can vote, let's say, in the first preference, you could vote, say, for Ralph Nader. And then in the second, you could vote for Al Gore. So, and the idea would be that if the top candidate doesn't get a certain percentage of votes, then those votes move down to the next one. And that means that you wouldn't be jeopardizing your what you consider your emergency choice as the lesser of the evils, and you'd still be able to vote for a positive candidate. And if the positive candidate doesn't make it, you haven't jeopardized the one that you think is, to use an ugly word, really, realistic, meaning being surrendered. So if that could be implemented, you would be somebody like Val Fader could win the election, because if people feel that they're not jeopardizing the lesser evil, then they could vote for Ralph Nader in the first place, and he could get the majority because that's that. And people would have the confidence that they're not jeopardizing anything, they're voting for something that they really like. And I believe that a form of that has now been implemented in Maine, which is a small state, and it appears that results from a certain degree of pressure developing into an idea where we could break out of the control of the duopoly and get a real, more of a people's vote rather than a manipulated vote of the people against themselves. To be given a left hook or a straight right. So I think that's what could be aimed for, and it would be a way of solving that duopoly problem, and it has to be confronted. Now, the other thing that was spoken about is the epidemic that's taking place right now, the coronavirus, which is spreading around the world. But we have to notice where that started. It started in China. What's the main country that it first spread to? Iran. Guess what China and Iran have in common? They're both targeted by imperialism. And these viruses, they want us to believe that, okay, there's a new virus on the block, just arrived here. And it's strange that in the past, there haven't been many brand new viruses just arriving anyplace. It's only in the past few decades when the means existed to genetically engineer biological warfare against populations. And we've seen very peculiar epidemics that mainly attack targeted people, like AIDS, for example, which you look at the initials for it, HIV. In other words, going after people that are oriented in the same sex, so-called homosexual, IV, those who use IV drugs, which happens to coincide with spreading epidemics among oppressed people that have problems, while the system stokes, for example, the drugs. They bring in the drugs from all over the world, and then they pretend that those who are guilty are somebody selling small quantities in a park or something, while they bring it in by the billions, while the whole banking system has largely become a money laundering system for the major drug trade, and this has been going on since before the opium wars broke out at the instigation of mainly the British Empire in the 1800s and the precursors to that in the 1700s. This is an international monopolistic, imperialistic thing, and it's used again to reinforce control. And that was AIDS, for example. You see Ebola, right? Like AIDS, Ebola rapidly spread in Africa. Nobody says where it came from, how it broke out, how come it wasn't there before, how come it comes in and dies out and comes in again. It's targeted biological warfare to by imperialists. These things do not spontaneously develop like they claim that the coronavirus jumps species from certain animals. Well, people have been living with animals for thousands and thousands of years. How come that these jumps are only taking place now? And when we look at the way that so they're creating this gigantic problem, and then they're posing a solution that could be worse than the problem itself. The solution is that we have to get into the habit of submitting to lockdowns, and we have to train the government in enforcing lockdowns around the world. For example, Italy now is totally locked down as a result, supposedly, of the of the coronavirus, and it's they create and instigate an epidemic, and then they present themselves as the people that are trying to prevent its spread, or maybe even find a prevention or a cure. But it's the same complex, the same money, the same pharmaceutical industries. And I'm not saying that everybody, probably the overwhelming majority of people who work in those industries believe in the benevolent face that those industries present, but in their interconnections with the great corporate and banking interests around the world, these people are manipulated and being put to work without really fully understanding what they're doing. And that's where I think our job comes in, that we have to explain this as much as possible and stimulate a real resistance to these fiends and these mass murderers, both in direct wars and in biological warfare against the populations that claim to be a government, that claim to be governing us, And even try to say that it's done with our consent, because, hey, look who got elected, dualistic monopoly. If this is what the people voted for, and, hey, they didn't vote very much for the Green Party, then it's the democratic way to keep the secret clique in power, mass murdering and brainwashing and robbing and lying to the population of the world that these are the people that are supposed to be fit to govern us. So we need mechanisms, and I say this also, you know, not to be too naive. We could fight for something, let's say, like this dual voting electoral system. And as we see the frustration that we get with the political system, the way it is set up now that they don't want to implement. Then we see that we step by step begin to learn and train ourselves that more rather than less is needed in terms of escalating the tactics so there could be a real people's power that's enforced by the real people, the overwhelming majority that's being systematically victimized by the tiny minority doing so in the name of majority rule, democracy, and so on. What we need is a real democratic republic meaning, there are various names for it. It could be called socialism. Some people could be afraid to use the word communism, but it means people come together as a community and exert the real power of the people.
Thank you so much for that, Joel. It is brilliant. I wanted to program the music to go to be dialed down so that people could hear that. Thank you again, my brothers and sisters. Next week, we will have Gwen Goodwin to speak up on what's happening. Thank you for listening. Good night, my brothers and sisters. Mic off.